Hello and welcome to Power Pros Podcast, episode 100, Ice Cream Island Riding Camp. I am your host, the Hoff, Chris Hoffman, and with me is my co-host and nemesis, Pete Michaud.
What's up, Hoff Pants?
Well, funny you should ask. We have another big week of discussion about what's going on in the world of Nintendo, and as I just said, we have somehow reached our 100th episode here at Power Pros. I never thought we would make it this far. When we made it to episode 6, I was like, wow, how did we make it to 6 episodes? And then we made it to 25. Like, how did we make it to 25 episodes? Yet here we are, episode 100.
Wow, it's pretty cool. Are you, like, a proud parent right now, or what?
I'm pretty astounded and happy that we made it this far. And, of course, we never would have been here at all if it weren't for Nintendo Power Magazine, since that's where both of us made our name as far as being Nintendo experts goes. So that's going to be our big topic. We got some excellent questions from our listeners all about Nintendo Power, and so that will be the big topic this week.
It's exciting.
However, before we get to that, let's kick things off with some news. Specifically, last week, Nintendo had a little Nintendo Direct to drop a whole bucket load of Splatoon 2 news on us. There was all kinds of information about weapons and modes and online functionality, so let's talk about that a little bit, starting with the new weapons and sub-weapons and special weapons. We've got the Clash Blaster, which is a new short-range, fast, explosive weapon, the Flingza Roller, which has fast horizontal slings, but extra far yet slow vertical swings, the GooTuber, which holds a charge for an extra long time that you can use for sneak attacks. We've got the Dapple Doolies. We've got the Autobomb subweapon that hunts down enemies. And then we've got all these new special weapons, including the Tenta missiles, which lock onto your opponents and launch into the air and coming down as multiple projectiles. The Inkjet that lets you fly through the air, kind of like Mario's Flood, and fire explosive ink at your enemies. The Stingray that lets you shoot through walls. The Splashdown that causes a huge ink explosion as you dive down from the air. The Inkstorm that causes it to rain ink. The Bomb Launcher that fires a barrage of bombs for a limited amount of time, the Ink Armor that temporarily makes you and your allies invulnerable to attacks, and then the Baller, which is a giant explosive hamster ball that lets you climb up walls or anywhere and then explodes in a burst of ink. Do any of these new weapons stand out to you?
For a minute, I thought you were just making them up. You had such a long list. Well, I mean, name alone, the GooTuber is maybe the coolest name for a weapon I've ever heard in my entire life. What do you think?
The GooTuber's not bad, but for me, it's all about the baller. I mean, they had me at giant explosive hamster ball. I don't really know why there's a hamster ball in Splatoon or why a squid would be in a hamster ball, but whatever it is, I like it. It's pretty darn cool.
Yeah, there's a lot of questions around that one. I think that if it was a capybara instead of a hamster, maybe you would be more interested in that, perhaps?
Well, I'm already very interested in it, but yes, that's probably the only way it could be better is if there were a capybara involved.
Now, do capybaras ever go in balls? Have you ever seen that?
Not of their own accord, I'm pretty sure of that.
Right, they're not like real-life Pokemon or anything?
But then again, I don't think that squids do either, so I wouldn't worry about that too much.
All right.
We also got some news about the multiplayer and online modes, and other than the co-op Salmon Run mode, there really don't seem to be a whole lot of new online multiplayer modes. There's still Turf Wars, There's still the Splat Zones, Tower Control, and Rainmaker in ranked battle. And there is a new League battle that lets you play with friends, but there aren't really any new competitive modes per se. So that was a little bit disappointing. And then it's also disappointing that you still can't choose when you play these specific modes. For ranked battle, it's like you can only play specific modes at specific times. And it turns out that Salmon Run is the same way. You can't just go online and do co-op Salmon Run with your friends at any time. You have to wait for very specific times. And I think that that is just nuts, especially if we're going to have to pay for the online functionality next year. You know, we had better be able to play whatever modes we want at any time. So I think that's kind of crazy. You can still play this stuff locally anytime you want.
Right.
But I feel like, you know, by now, in this day and age, we should have come a long way from Splatoon 1. You should be able to just go online and play the mode of your choice at any time. So I'm not terribly thrilled about that.
Yeah, I feel like that's a fair gripe. But other than that, I mean, this whole announcement, there's a lot of stuff here, right? A lot of content for Splatoon 2 in general. I feel like it's really the definitive version of Splatoon.
Well, I suppose it is so far. And aside from my gripes about not being able to choose your online modes, there are a lot of other cool things that they've talked about. For example, even though there is no Miiverse on the Switch, they're like, oh, you know, whatever, we're going to make our own Miiverse specific to Splatoon 2. So you can just go in there and you can make your own drawings and you can post them, and then they will show up randomly in the levels and within Inkopolis, which is pretty darn cool.
Yeah, that's great. I think that's so cool.
And then there are also the new characters. Callie and Marie are tied up in story mode, but we have this new talk show and or music group with Pearl and Marina, aka Off the Hook. What do you think of these new characters, and are you on Team Pearl or Team Marina?
I'm probably a Team Marina myself. But yeah, I mean, obviously, any new characters to this series are just welcome additions.
Yeah, I like them. I think I'm probably on Team Pearl myself, but I like them both, and I am already clamoring for new amiibo of these characters. You know, it took a while for us to get us Callie and Marie when the first Splatoon came out, so I'm hoping we will get these two eventually. But perhaps even bigger than all this stuff is the fact that they have finally given out more details about the app that's going to be used for a lot of the online functionality. That will be launching alongside the game on July 21st. It's going to be called Nintendo Switch Online. Very creative name there. And then you will go into the Splatnet 2 portion of the app, and that provides schedules for when the online modes and stages will be available. It'll give you your stats, gear info. It'll let you actually order gear that way, and of course invite other players to private battles, plan for league battles, Splatfest battles, and you will use your voice chat. Plus, on top of that, you can use it to invite your friends to play over social media, which is a pretty neat feature.
Yeah, I know you've had kind of mixed feelings about this. I still think it's
I still think it's weird going outside the Switch itself and requiring people to own a smartphone to do a lot of this stuff. But
you know, maybe it's an initiative that Nintendo wants to do so that they can guarantee that people using it are mainly of age or of like a reasonable age where their parents feel comfortable having them talk over a phone to other people, which I know sounds funny, but that is it's a very Nintendo thing I could see them doing.
Maybe. But, I mean, whatever the reason is, it does sound like the app is going to be fully featured, whether it's the ideal situation or not. At least it sounds like it's going to have all the stuff that we want it to have. So I do applaud them for that. We'll know more about it, whether that's actually true, once we get our hands on it in the near future. But at least it's going to have a lot of functionality in it.
Yeah, from a technical standpoint, I would actually say that I like the idea, and possibly because it takes the resources away from the machine having to do, the console itself is having to do voice over IP and using some of the precious bandwidth for that, then you're actually potentially getting some lag or things aren't happening quite as fast as they could be if you dedicated a lot of that resources to voiceover. So honestly, your phone is designed for it. So I kind of like that.
That might be exactly the reason they're going this
way. Yeah, I kind of like that idea. So we'll see how it works.
Yep. They also mentioned that there are going to be content updates coming for a full year after the game comes out, which is pretty great. One of those first new updates is going to be the Splatbrella weapon, which works not only as a weapon, but as a shield. There's also going to be a new bubble blower weapon. There's going to be new gear, and there's going to be some new stages, including this really nifty-looking stage with a boat, and then this really cool-looking bridge stage. Those look really great. And they say there's going to be 2 years of Splatfests after the game comes out. That's a long time. A long time to do Splatfests. And you'll now be able to team up with your friends in the Splatfests, which you could not do before.
Yeah, I kind of think that's a cool move. I mean, I'm in the mindset now where when I buy a game that's got multiplayer like this and it's so multiplayer focused, it's kind of fun when they add more content. It kind of keeps you coming back to it for an extended period of time.
Yep, absolutely. And perhaps the biggest news of all about this is that the first Splatfest is going to be this coming weekend. There is a new demo that's available right now, Splatoon 2 Splatfest World Premiere. You can grab it from the Switch eShop, and you can choose your side between cake and ice cream. And then play the game from 3 p.m. to 7 p.m. Pacific time this Saturday. And, see which side is going to win.
So, Chris, are you more of a cake or an ice cream kind of man?
Well, it's a trick question. I'm a pie guy.
I knew
you know that.
know that. I was going to say, if it was pie, hands down, pie. So between cake and ice cream, though, what do you got to go with?
I'm actually team cake. I went with team cake.
All right. But you would go with team pie if there was one.
I would. So yeah, that thing is out there now. You can go grab it. You can make your character. You can check out Inkopolis. And then you can get ready to do some splatting come July 15th.
Yeah, pretty cool.
Yep, very much so. But speaking of games with online content and frequent updates, the new ARMS update is out now. That features new playable character Max Brass, as well as a whole bunch of other stuff. Pete, have you had a chance to play this yet?
I have not, although I really would like
to, actually.
Yeah, I know. I'm the worst.
That's okay. I haven't played it either. I did finally play the game a little bit and played through it on difficulty level 2, but the new content update was not out yet when I played, so unfortunately we will have to wait for that. Another game, though, that's going to be getting a really cool content update later this summer is Cave Story. We already knew it was going to be getting a multiplayer update sometime soon, and I don't know if this is going to be in the same update or a separate update, but there's also going to be an update that adds the old-school, low-res, original Cave Story graphics. So if you're a fan of this game and you're like a real purist and didn't like the fact that things have been rezzed up a little bit in Cave Story Plus for the Switch, well, here you go. Here is a new option for you. Personally, I like the new high-res graphics. So I'll probably keep it that way. But anytime they add in, you know, new functionality like that, I always think it's really cool and it's a good reason to go back and revisit the game a little bit more.
Yeah, definitely give it another playthrough or something.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And then we also got an update on The Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild. There's still updates coming for that. They're going to be a little bit more further out than the ones we've just been talking about. But yes, there was news about this game from the Japan Expo, which was held in France just last week. And we found out some details about the Champion's Ballad DLC. That, of course, is the second batch of DLC that's going to be coming late in the year.
Right.
Mostly, we just learned that you are still playing as Link. You do not play as Zelda. You know, I was hoping you could play as Zelda. A lot of other people were speculating you could play as Zelda. You know, they left Link out of the art and just showed Zelda and the Champions. But no, Anuma has confirmed you are still playing as Link. So he has crushed my hopes and dreams when it comes to that.
Sorry, pal.
Still looking forward to it, but yeah, can't do that. And the other little bit that they announced is that the lobster shirt that Link wore in Wind Waker is going to be part of that DLC package.
Pretty awesome.
It's kind of hilarious. Awesome and hilarious both.
You know, I thought one of the coolest things about this announcement was that they kind of showed that, like, pre-release footage, which you really, like, can you think of a time where Nintendo ever showed sort of, like, work-in-progress video from a game?
Oh, I'm sure they've done it plenty of times.
Yeah, but, like truly, like, it had, like, numbers running at the top where, like, you could tell that it was just, like, totally unpolished.
It's true. You don't usually get stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah. So I thought that was kind of an interesting new face of Nintendo. We'll see what that means.
Mm-hmm, yeah, cool. Definitely nice to see that behind-the-scenes look. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And in related news, Nintendo has also confirmed that there will be a Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild art book coming later this year. In Japan, anyway. We knew that there were going to be several Zelda books coming this year. And this is the third one and the final one that they had talked about previously, although they hadn't divulged any details until now. Hopefully, that will be announced to be coming to North America alongside the Hyrule Encyclopedia, which also is still not yet confirmed for North America. But I'm crossing my fingers that those will both come out. I mean, the last two that we got from Dark Horse were totally fantastic.
Right.
And so I'm kind of expecting they'll be publishing these as well. And if that happens, I'm sure they'll be just as excellent. So continuing to cross my fingers for that.
Yeah, that's cool. I mean, Breath of the Wild has such a cool art style and such a departure, I think, from the other Zelda stuff. I mean, maybe not a departure, but it's definitely like a little bit more explored. A lot of new mechanical enemies and things like that. It's good look, I think.
Yeah, and they obviously went through a lot of iteration to try to perfect the look of the game, and so I'm sure there's going to be a ton of really cool, interesting stuff in there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Moving on to something that's very, very far away from Hyrule, the folks at 2K have revealed that World Wrestling Entertainment is coming back to Nintendo systems. That's right, WWE 2K18 is going to be coming to Switch this October.
Can you smell what the Switch is cooking?
Oh, yeah! Supposedly, it's not going to cut any corners. It's going to have all the same content as the game that's coming out on other systems. So it's going to have all new 8-man tag matches. It's going to have these new grapple carry moves, a new career mode, tons and tons of customization features,
awesome.
And DLC characters and all that. You know, we haven't had a chance to see this version of running or anything, so we don't know 100% that that's true. And in the past, like with the Wii, they did skip on content, but right. It sounds like from everything they've said so far, this is going to be arriving day and date and feature complete when compared to the other systems, and that is pretty darn excellent. Glad to see that, you know, Switch is bringing in the third parties.
Yeah, I think that's huge. I mean, yeah, I think between this and Rocket League and FIFA, I think you're kind of really hitting a lot of the people who want to play these like multiplayer style games portably, and it's pretty cool. I think the having this is a huge win in the Nintendo camp.
Yeah, it's been a long time since WWE fans have been able to enjoy the games on Nintendo systems, and so I know a lot of other people are really happy to have him back.
Yeah, and I think it's just an overall like good like temperature check for the console. It means that the third parties are at least thinking about what it's like to release content on the Switch.
For sure.
And so hopefully that's a sign of things to come.
Yep, absolutely. Now, we don't have any new game impressions to discuss this week, but we do have a review of sorts of something else to talk about, and that is the Castlevania animated series on Netflix.
Oh, man, that was good stuff, right?
Yeah, I would say it is. You know, this is something we were talking about last week, and now it is out. And yes, I have to say, I did enjoy it. I was pretty worried going into it because the stuff they had shown, you know, the tone just seemed, you know, very, very dark and didn't really remind me of the games that much.
Mm-hmm.
But I actually thought that it worked pretty well after watching the show. Now, the show is mostly based on Castlevania III Dracula's Curse.
Mm-hmm.
It's got a bunch of Symphony of the Night elements thrown in there as well. And then, like, they sort of combine all that with Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
So it's very violent and bleak and brutal and vulgar as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I was almost blown away at some points.
Yeah, this show is not for the kids at all. But despite all that, I think they did a really good job of bringing in a lot of Castlevania feeling elements. You know, early on, it's very weird because it just focuses on Dracula and they kind of humanize him. They're like, oh, look at Dracula. He's a very nice man. Isn't he nice?
I know.
And they do that for like the whole first episode. And then, you know, things happen. And then we see him, you know, why he becomes a villain, sort of. And so at first you're feeling sorry for him, and then you're feeling sorry for the humans, and then you like sort of don't like any of them. And then we bring in Trevor Belmont at the very end of the first episode, and he's kind of thrown into the middle of this, and he's not very likable at first either.
No.
But then he starts doing things and sort of comes around and starts turning into, you know, one of the vampire hunters that we've come to know and love in all the video games.
Yeah, and I actually think that's part of the Game of Thrones nod, is that like that show is great at making these characters that you hate at first, and then you start to realize, well, they're actually not such a bad person when you kind of understand the
plight.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it does a great job. You know, it's kind of crazy, as you mentioned, like, he doesn't get introduced. Trevor doesn't come in till the end of the first episode. And you think, it's like, there's only four episodes, or he's only in 75% of the show. kind of amazing when you think about it like that.
Yeah, I mean, because of the way it's structured, they almost shouldn't have made it four episodes. They should have made it like a Castlevania movie. It'd be an hour and a half long.
Right.
It's all still a prelude. You know, this thing is just getting going. There's obviously going to be a second season and stuff is going to happen. But this is sort of just a bunch of big setup things that's going on.
Yeah, it sounds like season two is supposed to be 8 episodes, so that's promising.
Mm-hmm. Yep, that's what I've heard.
And in general, I love this. And I kept thinking while I'm watching it, I was like, you know, I would just like, as many episodes as they would make, I would watch this. And it also made me realize that, like, man, they should really do more animes based on old school video game properties, but do them right like this. I mean, I know it's easier said than done, but man,
yeah,
if there was a Metroid one, if there was a Kid Icarus, I know they did some stuff for, you know, Uprising. More of this would be great.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I think having more stuff along those lines would be good, and especially when it's coming from people who do appreciate the source material. I mean, I think that's why this works. Despite the fact there are tons of changes to the story and to the characters, there are still all these little nods to the classic games. Like, it's set in 1476, which is the same year that was established for Castlevania III. There are these platforming bits at the beginning where he's like hopping on logs and going through a swamp and crawling through a sewer. And then, of course, there's that gear-filled tower at the end, which is obviously a huge nod to the clock towers and all the Castlevania games.
Yep. I know, right when I saw it, I was like, that's happening, for sure.
And then without getting into too much spoiler territory, there's even this enemy boss from the NES Castlevania 3 that I'm like, oh, wow, I can't believe they put in this boss character that actually does the same thing to one of the hero characters that it does in the game. And I just thought, you know, that was, you know, something they could have totally easily overlooked. It's such a minor thing, but it was very cool that they put it in there.
Yeah, you're right. And it's cool because if you don't know what it is, it doesn't really matter. You know, you just you're still interested. But if you do know, it's like, oh, sweet, I'm in on the joke kind of thing.
Yes, definitely.
And did you see the on Netflix when you actually like pull it up in the app? Did you notice what the box art looked like?
No, I don't think I did.
So on the Xbox, at least, I'm sure it's different on different formats, but pulling it up on the Xbox Netflix app.
Xbox. I can't believe you're using Xbox.
Well, if the Switch had one, I would use that. But
fair enough.
It actually has a little 8-bit Castlevania style, the original NES graphics. Yeah. So pretty cool.
No, I hadn't seen that. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, cool nod.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like that. So despite the concerns I had about the tone, I thought it turned out pretty well. Despite the fact that you know, Trevor's introduced kind of awkwardly, you know, I still had a really good time with it. It has great action. It has good animation. It has solid voice acting. If you're expecting it to be exactly like the games, you know, you're probably more likely to be a little disappointed. But yeah, I had a really good time with it.
You know, I actually totally agree. And one thing that I would like to mention also is just the social commentary in it as well, I think really works well for this day and age. There's just a lot of like people pulling strings and kind of turning people against each other. And it was it's just a, kind of this interesting story of like, you know, you think you know who the bad guy is, but actually, you're totally wrong.
Yes, I suppose that is true as well. Now, I think we just need Konami to get on the horn with Way Forward and make us a brand new portable Castlevania game, and everything will be awesome.
I mean, that would be perfect, right? Like, you have to be thinking that's what they would do, but who knows?
Let's cross our fingers that this animated series will also bring the game series back from the dead.
Nice.
All right, let's take a little intermission, and then we come back, we will discuss this week's big topic, which is everything you want to know about Nintendo Power and weren't afraid to ask. All right, we are back and we are ready to discuss this week's big topic, which is everything you want to know about Nintendo Power and weren't afraid to ask.
Sounds amazing.
This being the 100th episode, we've decided to do something special, so the whole big topic is going to be devoted to listener questions about Nintendo Power. I was with Nintendo Power for more than 7 years. Pete, you were there for, I think, about 3 years yourself, plus you were also a long-term Nintendo employee doing lots of other functions. But the point is that neither of us would be Nintendo experts or be doing this podcast if it weren't for Nintendo Power.
It's true.
So that's why we're reflecting back and celebrating our 100th episode, talking all about that legendary publication.
Memories.
And we got quite a response from our listeners. We got tons of questions. We have a lot to talk about. So let's just jump on in from the beginning and start answering this Q&A.
Let's do it. And Chris, in general, I really appreciate that you have me on for this. It's, you know, it's kind of fun to be part of a milestone podcast like this. So thanks for that.
Sure thing. Glad to have another Nintendo Power veteran joining me for this episode. And when I say we're starting at the beginning, I mean we are starting with the beginning of the magazine, because this first question comes from Adam Fowler, and he wants to know, what was your favorite Nintendo Power cover?
Man, that's a really tough one, because there are so many. What was there, like 285? Is that right?
Well, there were 285 issues. There were variants on top of that. But yeah, that's a lot of covers to go through.
Chris, I got to go with a classic. You might say the same thing, but I got to say the Castlevania cover.
Castlevania.
Issue number 2.
Oh, my. The infamous Simon holding Dracula's severed head issue.
Yeah, and mainly because, like, we always reference that issue as being, like, kind of unbelievable that that ever even happened.
It's not really that bad, but yes, it's kind of legendary because apparently it gave children nightmares and they complained.
Yeah, and you have this, like, live-action scene. But yeah, it's not that scary, but when you hear about the fact that the counselors got a lot of calls about it, it's really kind of sad. But we were never allowed to do anything similar to that ever again, except for the reshoot we did of me holding your head.
Yes, that is a thing that happened. Well, I'm glad that's your favorite cover and you are so entertained by its place in history. I decided to go with something that's a little more, artistically pleasing in my mind. If we're going to go with something really old school, I'm going to go with the Super Mario World cover on volume 28, or possibly, speaking of Castlevania, the Super Castlevania 4 cover from volume 32.
Nice.
And then if we're talking about newer issues, ones I was actually involved with, I would pick either volume 211, which was The Legend of Zelda Twilight Princess, or perhaps volume 250, which was Mega Man 10. Or maybe volume 230, which was Castlevania, Order of Ecclesia, which I think was a really underrated cover, but I thought was really cool. I love the color palette and the way it really focused on these blacks and reds, and just thought it was really nifty. And of course, the Mega Man one was like, that was the first time Mega Man had got a cover in pretty much forever. So that one was really exciting for me as well. And then Twilight Princess just looks beautiful. So
I mean, you're cheating. You got all these ones in your pocket. Like, that's not fair. There's plenty that I love too. I couldn't list them all, but I mean, they had some iconic covers.
Yeah, there were lots of ones that I like. It'd be really hard for me to narrow it down to just a single one, but those are my top five anyway. Our next question, it comes from Tyler's Gestalt, and he asks, what was your favorite cover game reveal? My vote belongs to ExciteBots, which was such a surprise. Pete, I don't know if you have anything to say about this topic, but for me, if it's just a cover mention, something that didn't get the full cover treatment, I would go with either Contra 4 or Mega Man 9. I was involved with both of those, and I feel like both of them kind of came out of nowhere, and both of them were these really exciting retro revivals of series I loved as a kid, so it was really cool to be able to get those on the cover. If we're talking about ones that actually got the full cover treatment, I would probably go with Knight's Journey of Dreams or the Mega Man 10 I was just talking about.
Yeah, I think I would go with Knight's as well. That was, to me, that was one of the ones where it was like, wow, I had no idea that was coming, and we covered it first, so that's pretty cool.
The next question comes from Brian Booth, who asks, what was your personal favorite section or column in the magazine? Hoff, I'm most interested in your favorite section of the magazine from the perspective of a reader, since you've told us your favorite column to write and edit. I suppose I should mention, for those who don't know, that my favorite column as an editor was the download section, just because I liked being able to dig up these obscure games and put a spotlight on these games that I think a lot of people might not have ever heard about. But from a reader perspective, when I first started reading the magazine, before I was ever involved with it, I guess I would have to go with Classified Information.
Nice. That was actually what I had listed, too.
Cool.
To me, that was like they let you in on the secret,
Very much so.
Pretty cool stuff. Now, I think from our time, I actually really liked Community. I thought we did a really good job of like kind of covering, a lot of different things that people were kind of doing in the world of Nintendo. I remember in particular, I did like a paper craft for Advance Wars that somebody made, and the guy even like posted it on his website and all that. It was pretty cool.
Yeah, there was lots of cool stuff we were able to bring into that community section. But going back to Classified Info for a second, I did get to work on that a little bit, and I'm happy to say that I was able to actually bring back the old manila folder treatment for what we were doing, like virtual console games and stuff like that. And so I was really happy that we were able to get that nod to the old original Nintendo Power look back into the magazine like that.
Yeah, you can't really have Classified Info without having the manila envelope. It just, there's something about it that just seems so top secret and hokey at the same time.
Well, it existed for a long time without that stuff, so I was glad to be able to bring it back.
I also really enjoyed the monthly top 10, or was it top 30? What, I forgot.
Yeah, the top 30.
Yeah, and I just thought that it was always cool kind of seeing like what games people were playing. Pretty much before the internet, that was kind of the way you like stayed in tune with what people were doing, and I always enjoyed looking at it every month.
Okay, moving on to the next question, which comes from Michael Opferman. He asks, what are the best and worst articles you saw in the magazine, including from yourself? For me, I would say my favorite article in the magazine would be the NES 25th anniversary article. That was something that we spent a lot of time preparing, and I think it ended up turning out really, really well. We got to talk about, you know, all the classic NES games, and we got to bring in all these famous game personalities, sometimes talking about the games they worked on, sometimes talking about games they had nothing to do with. But, you know, we ended up with Hideo Kojima and Yuji Naka talking about Super Mario Brothers on this one single spread, and that was just one of the most amazing things that I've been involved with. Like I said, it took a lot of work. We had to plan this stuff out well in advance, but I think it turned out really, really well in the end.
Yeah, that's good stuff.
As for worst articles, okay, I don't want to throw anybody under the bus here, but for my least favorite article, I'm going to go with The Bad Girls of Marvel Nemesis, Rise of the Imperfect in volume 197. Because it was just sort of an embarrassing article. Because the tone was all like, hey, check out how hot these ladies are. Which really didn't fit with Nintendo Power's tone, even after the redesign. But to make it even worse, like, the characters weren't really sexy or anything. Or bad girls. So, like, trying to assume that tone and then really forcing it into something where it didn't fit, it just seemed really, really out of place, and so I don't think it worked at all. So.
That's weird. That was on my best list, but just kidding. So for me, I guess, okay, I know what my worst is. I wrote a tips and tricks for Geist. And while it was fun, Geist is not a really great game.
No, it's not.
I apologize if there's any Geist lovers out there. Yeah, in particular, I had one trick that was kind of garbage. It was, you know, you're playing multiplayer locally on one television. You can absolutely watch somebody else's screen. And in that game, it was very easy to kind of see when somebody was in Geist mode or like ghost mode, basically, mm-hmm. at a glance. And if you knew that, you could kind of screen watch them a bit because you knew they weren't going to be able to, like, kill you until they got into a person's body. Anyways, definitely a cheap trick, but I remember thinking, like, there was some staffers that, like, totally lost their minds that I put that in there. So
that was actually the issue just before I joined the magazine, so I cannot take any blame for either the content of the Geist article or the Bad Girls of Marvel Nemesis. So.
You're a bad girl.
Thank you. Another one from Mr. Opferman. He wrote, anything you worked on that didn't get into the magazine? Pete, did anything that you wrote somehow, you know, not make the cut for one reason or another?
You know, nothing really springs to mind.
Okay. Well, there were a couple things for me.
Yeah, sure.
In my first issue, I did a segment about the Game Boy Micro that focused on the interchangeable faceplates of the system. Mm-hmm. Sort of, you know, which faceplates are right for you, depending on what kind of gamer you are. But, you know, that feature ended up kind of falling by the wayside, and so that bit of the article got chopped out. And then there was also part of that aforementioned NES 25th anniversary feature that got cut. I can't really get into what it was, but it was something that we had to remove. And Nintendo was like, you know, maybe by the time the 30th anniversary comes around, you can talk about that. But of course, by the time the 30th anniversary rolled around, we were already out of business. So that didn't happen. But yes, there were definitely things I worked on that wound up on the cutting room floor. Our next one comes from Kyle Covino. He says, is there a favorite article or feature that you worked on that you're really proud of? On the flip side, is there one that you're like, oh boy, I can't believe I did that? I guess for me, aside from the things I've already mentioned, there's one article that's actually kind of both. It's one that I am very proud of, and I also can't believe I actually did that. And that is the Now You're Cooking with Power article, which was an article all about cooking games where it involved a photo shoot where I dressed up like a chef and I chopped off my finger for pretend. I'd had an octopus stuck on my face and covered myself like in cake batter and then served my severed finger to Chris Shepherd in a sandwich. And I really can't believe they actually let me get away with any of that.
I actually vividly remember that, so nicely done.
Well, you're probably just, you know, sitting back munching popcorn watching me, you know, put an octopus on my head.
Yeah, I remember your faces being pretty animated.
Yeah, it turned out pretty well.
Yeah, for me, I think the top 200 that I got to work on was pretty fun.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and It was, I think it might have started before your time, so you didn't really have any hand in the rules, and I remember you being a little bit chuffed about that.
Yeah, I think most of it had already run, like 60% of it had already run by the time I joined the magazine.
Yeah, and like we did it as scientifically, you know, reasonable as possible, and of course tried to account for, you know, being super overwhelmed by how awesome Resident Evil 4 was at the time. That just came out a few months ago. It's like hard to be unbiased about it. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, I think it was a 5-part thing that ran in 5 consecutive issues.
Yeah, I think so.
And it was super fun. I remember my favorite part was that we just kind of randomly called out specific ones in the list. Mm-hmm. And I got to write funny little blurbs and quips about each one. And it was one of my fond memories of writing for the magazine.
Cool. The next question comes from Jonathan Sopkak, who asks, what happened with the spine art misprints? I remember there being a misaligned Mario. Overlooked? So for people who aren't familiar with this, this was all the way back in 1997. Mm-hmm. And the idea was to have a sliver of Mario art on the spine of each issue so that when you line them all up on your shelf, you had this complete picture of Mario. However, one of the issues, issue 99, had the wrong art, so it messed up the whole concept. And they tried to, you know, fix the next issue and put in the correct art, but, you know, that doesn't really work unless you take 99 and, like, you know, throw it in the dumpster or something. So, but then it was too late. So, you know, unless you threw away 99, it was all messed up. But anyway, that was like 8 years before I joined up with Nintendo Power, so I have no idea what happened. I would assume, yes, it was just human error. That was well before your time too, Pete, but if you have any insight, please feel free to share it now.
No, nothing, but I think it's kind of the amiibo box boy of the spine art. It was just, it was the one that didn't make sense.
All right, if you say so. Our next question comes from Ryan Silberman, who asks, how does it feel to have ever played Mega Man Legends 3? Pete, obviously you have not played it. This is a question directed at me, and so I will say my feeling is fortunate. Lucky, I guess. You know, I'm one of the few people who ever got a chance to play an English version of the game before it got canceled. So yeah, I count my lucky stars that I had that opportunity.
So tell me, how did that happen exactly?
Well, we did a feature on the game. I went down to Capcom and checked it out. And then we ran the feature in the magazine. But then, you know, shortly after that, like right after we went to press, maybe even before the issue was out, they announced that it was getting canceled. It was not going to be coming out in any way, shape, or form. The thing is, this was just a demo. It wasn't even a full game. It was just what they called the prototype version, and it would have just a handful of missions, and it was going to be available for like $2 or something. And then they would use that as the basis to decide if they were going to produce the entire game. But for some reason, they, you know, gave it up beforehand, just like, nope, not happening. We're just throwing this thing away. No Mega Man Legends for you.
Crazy.
Yeah, and it was really sad because they had this whole community feature going on, and they were actually having the fans contribute character ideas and boss ideas and level ideas, and so it was very disappointing when that got thrown by the wayside.
What year was that, just set for context?
It was 6 years ago, so 2011.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, I mean, I do want to make it clear, it wasn't like the most amazing game I'd ever played or anything like that. It was fun, it was Mega Man Legends, but you know, it wasn't like some lost classic that you know, everybody should have played or anything like that. And of course, the fact that it didn't let you play Mega Man was always kind of weird. But still, I am glad I had that opportunity.
Yeah, that's cool.
The next question comes from Dayton, who asks, what was the most controversial review score you had? I would say that for myself, it was probably The Legend of Zelda Twilight Princess. Mm-hmm. I gave the game a 9.5. But it was controversial in the fact that we got a lot of readers who were very upset with me because I did not give it a 10.
Mm-hmm. Pretty much against your moral code to give a game a 10, I believe.
Well, a game has to be really, really amazing for it to get a 10. And, you know, I thought there were a few problems with Twilight Princess that could have been ironed out. And it's kind of funny because, you know, today people are like, oh, Twilight Princess, and they poop all over that game and complain all about it. And I think that they're kind of blowing their complaints out of proportion. But back when this first came out, some of the readers, some of the fans, they were not having it, and they insisted the game was perfect and should have got a 10. So because of that, that would be my most controversial review. Mm. What about you?
Oh, boy. You know, honestly, I can't remember what I gave this game, but do you remember Pack Picks?
Vaguely, yes.
It was a Nintendo DS game where
you kind of drew Pac-Man, right?
Yeah, you could draw Pac-Man, and and you had to sort of draw your own Pac-Man, and then he would animate and gobble up monsters, and you could draw lines to make him.
Reviewed that for another magazine, or at least played it for another magazine before coming to NP.
Yeah, I don't know what I gave it, but I know it was on the high end, and it probably didn't deserve it. I mentioned something about it being like a benchmark game that people will remember for years to come.
Well, that certainly wasn't the case.
That didn't prove to be so true.
Yeah, I mean, we all have reviews that we probably look back on and think we reviewed something too high. On occasion, things we scored too low. But yeah, it happens to everybody. Our next question, we have another one from Michael Opferman, who asks, what was the most tedious game you played for the magazine, and what was your favorite to review, not necessarily the highest or lowest rated? I'll start with the most tedious. I suppose that would be a game called War Men Tactics for WiiWare. And it was tedious not just because it was super hard, but also because it was just bad. It was bad and it was broken. Like, when you tried to start the game, first, if you tried to, like, put your cursor on the start button to start it, because it used the Wii remote pointer, it actually didn't work. And I spent a long time just trying to start the game, because if you tried to click on the button, it didn't work. I finally discovered if you click, you know, like 5 inches away on a different part of the screen, that would let the game begin. Mm-hmm. And then it would say on or off when you start the game. On or off.
On or off.
That's not what's supposed to happen when you do game start. I think you had to choose on and the game would actually begin. So that was a terrible game. Also, any hidden object game I had to review, I would consider very, very tedious.
Right. Like Mystery Case Files and all that?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, those didn't really float my boat.
Yeah, one that kind of comes to mind now that you're talking about it, I think, do you remember Odama?
Oh, yes, definitely.
And I feel like taking screenshots for that. So one of my roles at Nintendo Power was to take screenshots for the magazine. And sounds very easy, but for some games, it's quite hard. Especially Odama, there was like, you know, everything was very tiny and everything had to be very particular. And then the way we could capture stuff, because the Wii wasn't like a 1080p capture system, it's basically every other frame was just garbage. It was like you lost half of the image.
I don't think I realized that.
Yeah, so what it was like in between frames, you just wouldn't get it. So you'd have to kind of hope that you got the right capture on the right frame. Anyway,
Nasty.
Yeah, it was a tricky one. But that game wasn't fun overall.
Yeah, I can see why capturing screenshots would be hard for it, though.
Yeah, for sure.
As for my favorites to review, for some reason, I think Phoenix Wright Ace Attorney Justice for All, which was the second Ace Attorney game, that one is way up there, just because, you know, I really enjoyed the first one. I didn't have a chance to review it, so the fact I was finally getting to review a game in that series made me really happy. I love reviewing The Last Story for some reason. That was one of the, you know, last major games to come out on Wii. I had a great time reviewing that. And then also Chrono Trigger DS and Final Fantasy VI Advance, just because, you know, those were two of my favorite games when I was younger, and so this was my opportunity to contribute sort of, you know, to those games' legacy. It's like, okay, these games I loved are coming back now on GBA, now on DS, and I get to review them and write about them, and that was awesome. Of course, it wasn't awesome when you erased my game, but other than that, it was pretty awesome.
Well, at least you've gotten over it. You know, one of the best parts about my job was that I really just got to kind of goof around and play a lot of different games. You know, if I had to take a screenshot for, you know, this game or that game, you know, I got to play most of the games that came out each month. So honestly, I'd say the most tedious part of that was your request for specific screenshots. I think I've mentioned this before, but, you know, you'd want something very, very particular. Like, I want you to play Mega Man and get to the midway boss, and I want you jumping and shooting, and a shot is just about to hit his head while, you know, the dragon is spewing beams at you and you're jumping.
Hey, I'm not going to take it easy on you, man. The art of screenshot taking is very specific. Do it right or don't bother doing it, you know?
It's true. Mm-hmm. It's true. I agree.
Okay, next question comes from Jeffrey Skull, who asks, were there any games you weren't excited to review that ended up becoming favorites? And in general, my answer to this one would be no, not really, because usually by the time it comes around to review time, you already know a lot about the game, you know, if you're going to like it or not, you've seen it in action. However, the one game that I really didn't ever get to play until I was doing a review simultaneous with a feature was Chibi Robo. And that game, I wasn't really expecting much from. It kind of snuck up on me out of nowhere. I ended up really liking it. I wouldn't say it's one of my all-time favorites or anything, but I did really enjoy that game. And I never would have known that going into it. It was pleasantly surprising and enjoyable.
That's a good call. I don't really have any that I reviewed that ended up becoming my favorite, but like I would say like a sleeper that I wasn't necessarily expecting to be that great was Tetris DS.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I thought, I mean,
yeah, I could see
of
that.
Of course it was going to be good, but that game was really good. And additions of the NES characters into it were so, so fun. And the game had a lot of replayability, especially with the online mode. I loved that version of Tetris.
Yeah, that was a great one. I could understand like going in like, oh, it's just another Tetris, but then it turned out being completely fantastic. Yep. So totally understandable. Our next one is from Mr. Video 95, who asks, are there any reviews in the magazine that stick out in your mind? And I would say there are a few. New Super Mario Brothers, the original one on DS, really stood out because that was one where we did four reviews from four different reviewers. I think that's the only time in the magazine that that ever happened. And it was just such a monumental release that we decided, sure, this deserves to be reviewed by four different people. And of course, it was the first 2D Mario in forever. So that was really thrilling. I was really excited to be a part of it. So that one really stands out. Twilight Princess and Skyward Sword, because they were just, you know, big reviews of big games in one of my favorite series. So you know, those really stood out to me. And then there are four reviews that stand out because of the score, even though I was not actually involved with any of these. And those are Super Mario Galaxy, Super Mario Galaxy 2, Metroid Prime 3, and Super Smash Bros. Brawl. And Metroid Prime 3 got a 10. It was the first 10 that the magazine gave out, I believe, since it adopted the new format and actually had scores that went up to 10. Like Resident Evil, I think, you know, technically got a perfect score, but that was out of like, you know, a 5-point scale done by like, you know, 8 different people. So it's not really the same thing.
Right.
So Metroid Prime 3 was the first 10 we gave out, and I really didn't think it deserved a 10. Was it great? Yes. Was it a 10? No. Probably a 9 or a 9.5. So I kind of wish that that had not happened. And along the same lines, Super Smash Bros. Brawl got a 10. We know how terrible the online was. That alone should have dragged it down into lower territory, so I think that was rated too high. On the other hand, Super Mario Galaxy, I thought, did deserve a 10. It's like one of the few games that I would give a 10 to, and I really wanted to review it, but I just couldn't. And so it would, you know, quote unquote, only got like a 9.5, but man, I wanted to give that game a 10 so badly. However, then Galaxy 2 came around, and I was like, okay, here we go. We can finally correct this. We can make up for what happened last time. We can give this game the score it deserves. And what does Chris Slate do? He gives it a 9.5 again and does not give it a 10. Even though I would have given both Galaxies a 10, it didn't happen for either one. So I know it's just kind of, you know, nitpicking when it comes to scores being that high. But yeah, I firmly believe that both Mario Galaxies were worthy of getting a 10. The next question comes from Jason Williams, who asks, did NP really score first-party games better simply because it was an in-house magazine? That seemed to be the conventional wisdom. And my answer to that is no. No. We did not. I know a lot of people would like to think there was some sort of conspiracy about that, but the fact is we were really lucky in that Nintendo tends to make really darn good games. Yep. So we don't usually have to inflate our scores to give them a good score because they're usually pretty fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, we can't really speak to the entire longevity of the magazine. There may have been
only our tenure there.
Yeah, there might have been an old guard that was doing that. I don't think so. And as you mentioned, there really wasn't, you know, there wasn't some secret like meeting where they'd come out and say, okay, you must give this a 10.
Right.
And I think that...
And they were usually, you know, the higher-ups did have to give approval to the magazine, but they were very hands-off when it came to the reviews. They appreciated that part, you know, had to be something left to the editors. And if the magazine was going to be taken seriously, they knew we had to be able to just give our honest opinions.
Yeah, and I remember that coming up a few times, just like in conversations around the office, basically saying like, you know, the consensus is that we like pad these stats for our, you know, Nintendo games. But the funny thing is that if you actually looked, especially during our time, if you looked at the like the Metacritic score and then you looked at
Game rankings.
Yeah, where our score fell in. we absolutely never gave the highest score, or even remotely sometimes the highest score. It was like,
yeah, it's true.
Yeah, so
ours were usually a little bit lower.
It's kind of funny. It's one of those things where perception is sometimes, you know, stronger than reality, and the reality was that it didn't happen. And I think it's kind of a little bit of urban legend, but you know, in essence, Nintendo Power was a little bit advertainment.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we were in the marketing group when we were there at Nintendo. But still, when it came to the reviews and stuff, you know, they let us do our thing. And that's why we were able to give Geist a 5 out of 10. And Wave Race Blue Storm ended up with a 3.5 out of 5. And, you know, some people are like, is that right? But in the end, they let us, you know, go with what we felt was right. So that is the truth behind that.
Yeah. And hats off to them for letting us do that, by the way.
Yeah, totally. Next question is from Jason Hyman, who says, your coverage of Epic Mickey is what made me really want to get that game, but be honest, how much did you really like that and other cover story games? Well, here's the thing about the games that go on the cover, and that is, you win some, you lose some. When it comes to Epic Mickey, I never really played the game that much, to be honest, but you try to go with something that's going to be great and it's going to be an interesting story. And a lot of the times, it's quite a ways out before the game is done. So sometimes it ends up being great, and sometimes it isn't. I think it ended up being an interesting story, and the game looked really cool. Obviously, Epic Mickey had some problems, but, you know, before it's done, it's really hard to know. I will say that I loved Epic Mickey, The Power of Illusion on 3DS. I know a lot of people did not like that game, but I loved that one.
Yeah, I think in the end, it actually did pretty much get good reviews. And like you said, you kind of live and die by the sword when you, it comes to magazine covers. But I didn't play that game a ton, but I did like how it used the Wii Remote. And, you know, it was a big sort of a milestone game for Nintendo to have such a big property IP on the Wii.
We have another question here from Jeffrey Skull, who asks, any other games aside from Wii Music that Nintendo made that you guys ignored or were a little too kind to that were pretty bad? So, you know, let me clear things up about this. We didn't necessarily not review Wii Music because it was bad, per se. We avoided reviewing it because it didn't really fit in with the reviews section. Like, you know, is this even a game? Does it count as a game? Is it just, you know, some other type of software product? And does our regular review approach actually work for that? Would it be fair to have that game in there and, you know, give it whatever we give it while comparing it to like a Super Mario Galaxy or a Zelda or something like that? And we kind of felt that wouldn't be adequate. And that is the exact same reason that we did not put a review score on Wii Fit. And Wii Fit, obviously, that's a really excellent game, but we didn't review it just because we felt it wouldn't be appropriate to be like, oh, let's give this game a 9. And it's like, well, that's the same thing you gave Resident Evil. Right. Are you saying this game's as good as Resident Evil? Well, no, it's completely different. So we're just not going to give it a review. We didn't review, you know, Wii Fit Plus either. So that is the story behind that one.
Did you review Personal Trainer Cooking?
I don't believe so. But,
yeah, I mean, along those same lines, there's a lot of games Nintendo releases, especially now, that, you know, almost non-games. So, yeah, there's no surprise that Wii Music, you know, didn't make the cut for that kind of reason.
Now, yeah, I think that the brain training games probably did, and I'm sure Nintendogs did, but that was before my time, so I wouldn't have been involved with any of that stuff. Next question comes from Super Game Joy, who asks, did you get to keep any of the demo or review cartridges after reviewing games? And my answer is certainly, you know, not from Nintendo. In fact, the way that it worked with Nintendo products was that they were always kept locked up, safe and sound. When we were, you know, working outside the Nintendo offices out here in San Francisco, Nintendo would bring us special 3DS systems with the games locked into them. We would get to play them for a certain amount of time, you know, a couple of weeks, and they would come and they'd take them back. And, you know, even if we, you know, had considered, you know, doing something with the ROMs, you know, we would never have that opportunity. For Wii, we had special Wii systems that could actually download games and store several games on them, and they would send us the games via the internet, and then they would be deleted when we didn't need them anymore. Now, for third-party games, we did receive cartridges for GBA games and DS games and 3DS games, but those are very expensive, and so usually the companies would come back right away when we were done with them and be like, hey, send those back to us. We need these back. We need to reuse these for other purposes. And so we would usually have to send those back in a timely manner. With that said, there were a few instances where like a publisher would go out of business or something and we would still have some of their cartridges, and so we were not able to send them back. I did not keep them. I left them there at the company I was with. Nintendo Power was published by Future at the time, and so for all I know, Future still has these ROMs that go to Destineer and have their tractor farming games on them or something. But no, I did not keep any of them personally, and I don't think anyone else at Nintendo Power did either. Although, okay, confession time: the Wii discs, those we didn't have to send back, and so I might have held on to my Mega Man 9 disc. It can't be used in anything. You can't run it on any system unless you have a Wii debug. But I might have just held on to it for posterity. On the other hand, Pete, I mean, did you ever consider, like, maybe smuggling out ROMs in your beard?
I mean, the thought had crossed my mind. No. Nintendo kept, they, as you mentioned, they kind of kept ROMs under lock and key. And not only was it impossible to take a game, you really had no desire to, since you'd like promptly lose your job and Reggie yeah. would like,
you would kick your ass and take your name.
Well, I didn't want to go there, but yes, I'm sure he'd like have a stern look at you as you're getting escorted into the parking lot. At the same time, the one thing that I will say about all this was that, we did get a lot of free product, right? Like, I remember just boxes showing up and we'd get a copy of Ratatouille on every console under the sun.
That's true.
And yeah. It was like, here, Pete, you want a PC version of Ratatouille? Like, no, I do not. So,
this does tie into our next question, which comes from Tyler, who says, I was wondering about these old SNES floppy disk copying machines. I know that it was possible to rip ROM files from Super NES cartridges using a bulky cartridge adapter, which could copy the game data to floppy disks. Were any of these machines officially used in the office? I know Nintendo takes a very hard stance against piracy. You don't have to name names, but I'm wondering if anyone that worked for Nintendo Power ever used Nintendo ROM files unofficially on their computers at home. Was this a socially acceptable thing to do among the staff? If someone did it, would they be fired if Nintendo found out? So to answer this question, that was way before my time. Super Nintendo had gone by the wayside and onto GameCube and onto Wii. I was certainly not aware of anyone that did anything like that. I think everybody who worked for Nintendo Power was very respectful of Nintendo's rules and Nintendo's stance on intellectual property rights. And I think it would be fair to say that it would not be acceptable if we caught anybody doing that. And yes, it would lead to very bad things, like getting fired, getting your name taken, and your ass kicked. So, yeah, there was nothing like that going on during our tenure there.
Yeah, for sure. I can second that.
This next one comes from Gabriel Van Gilder, who wants to know, how many of the NP staff were able to do the Super Mario Brothers Minus World trick? I will admit, I can't do it. I tried. The answer to that question is all of us. It is a little-known secret that was actually a job requirement. That was the final part of the job interview. You had to do the Minus World trick on the spot. And if you did it, you got the job. If you failed, then you got thrown down a trap door and into a pit of hot lava. Next question comes from Kyle Covino, who asks, what's it like working with your nemesis, both at Nintendo Power and afterwards? So here's the thing about having a nemesis. You need to have a worthy nemesis. I mean, who is Mario without Bowser? Who is Mega Man without Dr. Wily? So, if you have a no good, worthless nemesis, how can you have a good hero? So it's important to have a good one. So with all that said, it is naturally the bane of my existence to have worked with Pete and to be working with him again today.
Yeah, I'm not even sure how this happened exactly. I think you said this is a terrible idea, but what are you doing this week?
Mm-hmm. Yep, that's right.
The thing that I think that this like totally solidified itself as me being your nemesis when we did the... Now, do you remember in the Nintendo Power, I forget which issue, but we did sort of like the face-off between...
Oh, the point-counterpoint?
Yeah.
When we were talking about Smash Brothers,
yep.
Kid Icarus versus Solid Snake,
yep.
Who's the better new character?
And I was on the Kid Icarus camp, and you were on mm-hmm. Solid Snake.
Yes, and I think they drew me with a headband, and they drew you with the Kid Icarus crown thing on your head.
That's right.
In the end, I was probably on the wrong side of that one. But I was very excited for Snake being in there at the time.
Yeah. No, I mean, it was good. And, you know, I'm still a huge Kid Icarus fan. Yeah. It's fun. It's kind of cool. Chris, I don't know how you feel exactly, but the fact that it's been, you know, so long and we really haven't stayed in close contact, but I feel like this is kind of a good opportunity to, you know, chat again. And I still read Nintendo news like you wouldn't believe. And it's fun to be able to talk to you every week.
So in conclusion, it's terrible.
Yeah, it pretty much is.
Our next question comes from Jesse T., who asks, what were the guidelines and rules on deciding what fan mail made it into the magazine? How much mail was gone through every month? Was there ever a particular letter that was initially going to be in the magazine only to be rejected later on? And do you have any personal favorites or ones that have stuck with you through the years? So we went through hundreds of letters each month. Often when we were at Nintendo Power here at Future, we would have an intern who would help, you know, go through a lot of the stuff and sort out the ones that were totally junk and then pass along the ones that were at least possible contenders. But the main factor was it had to be something that was interesting and unique and could lend itself to a good answer. If it was something that we had covered before in a previous issue, then it probably wouldn't make it in. And a lot of times, something would make it in that was interesting and unique, and then we get lots of copycats being like, oh, well, that's a way to get myself in the magazine. Let's do that. Those wouldn't make it in. Like, for a while, you know, someone wrote in, like, they caught a little error in the magazine, so it went into a little thing called Corrector's Corner. And pretty soon, you know, everybody was trying to find mistakes in the magazine, and so eventually I'm like, you know what, even if there is a mistake in here, we're not going to run it because that's just, you know, inviting 100 people to write in trying to find mistakes, whether they're there or not. So there's that.
Oh, I always just thought that we, you know, use like a Ouija board or something to pick these letters.
Well, you might think so, but that was not true. Also, from 2007 onward, actually, it really helped if the letter was not about Pokemon, because anything involving Pokemon had to have like a special level of Nintendo approval. And because that took extra work and extra time, we decided it was usually better to not do Pokemon letters if we could avoid it.
That's really funny. And not surprising.
The only letters I can think of that were planned for inclusion and then rejected were in the final issue, just because we had so many great letters and we just couldn't fit them all in, and it broke my heart to not be able to include all of them. One of them was from a fellow named Mike Myers, who did PR for Jalico. Yeah, baby. And he was involved with getting Maniac Mansion on the cover of one of the early Nintendo Power issues, and so there was a letter all about that, and it killed me to have to cut that. Mm-hmm. But prior to that, you know, any letter that, you know, we ended up cutting, we still would probably put in the next issue because, well, we're going to still have a letters column the next issue, and so if it didn't fit this time, it'll still make it in next time. So that's pretty much how it worked. The next letter comes from Josh the Meme Lord, who asks, what was the best write-in letter? And that's a very tricky question, because it's not really the letters that stick with me necessarily, but more it's the responses, and, you know, maybe that's being egotistical, but you know, those are the things that stuck with me. So, like, I remember in issue 201, someone wrote in and asked, is Chris Shepherd an alien? And the response was a photo of I the monkey bursting out of his chest. In issue 203, someone asked for screenshots of the new Zelda game, and instead we ran a photo of Chuck Norris like bending a dude in half. Issue 204, someone wanted to know about a day in the life of the NP staff, and so we did this whole photo shoot that included, you know, a Nintendo Power dance off that I was in. I guess other ones that stand out were some letters about the picture of me being kissed by a My Little Pony character. And then there was this one letter that was all about the quiz that we ran in the April 2012 issue. And you know, anyone who read that quiz, here's the thing. The answer to all of those quiz questions was a fart.
What?
Because it was the April issue, that was sort of like a little April Fool's joke. There were only three questions, but the answer to all of them was a fart. And the way this guy wrote the letter and managed to never actually say the word fart, but described, you know, just how hilarious it was as he was reading these questions. That came across really well to me. So I really enjoyed that letter and it made me chuckle just as much as, you know, rereading the questions and seeing that we put a bunch of fart jokes in Nintendo Power in the April issue. So I think those are the ones that stand out to me.
Yeah, I really didn't have too much involvement in the letters, so I don't really have much to add on that front, but I always enjoyed hearing them before they were in the magazine. I seem to remember one with, like, Big the Cat coming up a lot.
Oh, there were a few with Big the Cat in there.
He's kind of a running joke.
I covered him a couple of times in the Don't Hassle the Hoff column. Speaking of which, that ties into the next question, which comes from Jody Anthony, who asked, how many people tried to hassle the Hoff? And the answer to that, a lot. Probably hundreds.
Yeah, I would just say everyone constantly.
Yes, pretty much. I think that's accurate.
Mm-hmm. But mostly me.
Yes, mostly. I mean, you count as hundreds just on your own.
Right. I had access to your, like, Final Fantasy VI save file, so.
Next question comes from Joey T., who says, do you know what the transition was like for Nintendo Power to preview Rare's 12 Tales Conker 64, then have minimal review and release coverage of Conker's Bad Fur Day? Would you elaborate on Nintendo's initial reaction to the final version and what you think their reaction would be in 2017? So, yes, this was way before my time at Nintendo. Pete, were you there for any of this?
It's funny because, like, for the magazine, no. But, like, you know, in testing, I was in the testing department when Conker's Bad Fur Day came through.
Did you ever get to play the previous version when it was not M-Ray, when it was just 12 Tales Conker 64?
I didn't. I just remember, you know, kind of reading about it and not being super, super looking forward to it just because it looked, you know, kind of like a baby game for babies.
Yeah.
But
okay, well, that's understandable.
Yeah, but the move to Conker's Bad Fur Day was pretty amazing that was happening.
Yeah. So, well, we can't really talk about, you know, what Nintendo's thoughts were at the time because neither of us were there, neither of us really know. We can say, as far as what their reaction might have been if it had come out later, that Nintendo did warm up to having M-rated game coverage in the magazine. You know, there were some periods of the magazine's history where that was a big no-no, but eventually that changed. And, you know, we had Resident Evil become a cover story. Silent Hill became a cover story. So I like to think that if Conker's Bad Fur Day had come out a few years later, we would have been able to give it more substantial coverage, albeit with a lot of disclaimers so people knew it wasn't a kid's game. And of course, we actually did get to cover the game in a playback page in 2008. So we did finally get to cover it and give it its due diligence at that time.
Yeah, did we ever do a Manhunt 2 cover?
No, sorry. Next question comes from Jason Lee. Did NP ever get any criticism for including the comics? I used to hate those, and I actually let my subscription expire at one time due to those.
Wow. You know, honestly, I always thought people liked the comics. I know I kind of did.
Huh. Well, I'll tell you this much. I know they got criticism because I was one of the people criticizing them back in the day. Just like this
like
guy.
Like a proper nemesis.
Yeah, I did not like these comics as a kid. And I was like, oh, these aren't anything like the games. And I'm like, why aren't these pages being devoted to game content instead? But, you know, what I learned over the years is if those pages weren't in the magazine, that just would have been pages that weren't in the magazine. There wasn't anything being cut to put in the comics. And also I learned to appreciate the fact that they were different and they weren't supposed to just be the games. So I've softened on that stance over the years. But yeah, there was definitely some criticism, but I don't know. I think you're right, Pierre. I think overall people did enjoy them.
Yeah, it wasn't, you know, the original was Howard and Nestor, right?
Yes. Yep.
So Howard, for some reason, like, I know it's like Howard Phillips. He looked like Nintendo's Pee Wee Herman or something. Like, he always wore a bow tie and like a suit. And I'm not really sure what his job was.
No, he was the professional video gamesman, of course.
Yeah, yeah. It was just kind of fun. I don't know where I was going with that.
I mean, that was okay. That was just one page out of every issue. It was more the big ones that I was like, well, why are they wasting space on, you know, these silly things? The Howard Nestor, it was never my favorite, but never bothered me either.
Yeah.
Now we have another question from Shu about the comics. What was the process for getting comics into the magazine? What were some cool ideas that never made it into NP? So when it came to getting comics in the magazine, usually, you know, it came from another department, like... When I was there, I think the only large comics we had were Pokemon. And basically, someone from another part of the company would be like, hey, we've got a Pokemon comic. We'd like you to run it. Is that okay? And we'd be like, yes, that's great. And then we put it in. So that's you know, it was pretty straightforward and simple. Although in this case, because it was a manga, I think we had to, like, you know, run it backwards. And so it was like bound in as a separate thing, and it was upside down, so that adds some extra complication.
Yeah, I remember that.
When it came to the stuff that we wanted to do ourselves, which, you know, didn't come up very often, but like having the return of Nestor in the 20th anniversary issue and then the final issue. You know, that was something that we had to go through approvals. We had to make sure that was something Nintendo was okay with. Then we would have someone write the scripts, we would hire artists, and there'd be a big back and forth to make sure that it happened. As for ideas that never made it into the magazine, you know, I'm not sure this question was really about the comics or not, but I'm going to pretend it is about comics. And that is, I thought it would have been great to have a successor to Howard and Nestor called Reggie and Pete. But sadly, that was not to be.
Yeah, it was like the odd couple.
I mean, there's similarities. You guys are both redheads, yeah, so I think it would have worked out pretty well.
He's like, you know, taking a bath and there's like, you know, beard hair everywhere.
Disgusting. No wonder it didn't happen. The next one comes from Super Game Joy. Why were the posters so awful and almost never of the game on the cover?
Wow. So, I take offense to this, I think.
Yeah, I think I do too. I don't think they were typically awful. I mean, you win some, you lose some. The posters kind of went away after we moved over to Future as a publisher. But during the years I was there at Nintendo, we had the posters every issue. There were some really good ones like Twilight Princess, New Super Mario Brothers, Metroid Prime 3, yep, Gunstar Superheroes, Children of Mana, and one of my personal favorites, Contra 4. There were also terrible ones like Justice League Heroes, The Flash, Metroid Prime Hunters, which didn't feature Samus and just had like this awful cutout art of all of the non-interesting Bounty Hunter characters in the game. Yeah, that turned out into a mess. Alien Syndrome was no good. Looney Tunes, Acme Arsenal, blah. But to get back to the question, really, you know, it was never intended to have to do with what was on the cover. It was just sort of an extra thing. And, you know, probably the reason that sometimes there were odd choices is because of the dimensions of the poster. You know, these were fold out 3 pages, so it was either very horizontal or very vertical because of these gatefold posters. Right. And so you couldn't always get great art to go on these posters. You couldn't use the same art that was on your cover to go on these posters because it just didn't fit. So I think that probably limited our choices some of the times. Another thing I'll say about the posters is that sometimes we would negotiate them. We were getting stories from third-party publishers, like Contra 4, for example. I think they originally wanted us to give that a cover story to get the exclusive scoop on that game, and we couldn't do that. We already had a cover story, but I'm like, oh, well, you know, I can probably put Contra 4 on a poster, and the publishers loved it. They love getting their games on posters. So that worked out really well for us. And can I say again how much I love that Contra 4 poster? Because, you know, the original Contra, you know, it's basically got Arnold Schwarzenegger and Sylvester Stallone fighting aliens on this game art. And so for Contra 4, we have Schwarzenegger, Stallone, Vin Diesel, and Wesley Snipes. Because we had 4 different characters in this game. It was supposed to be a 4-player game, which it wasn't, unfortunately. But still, you know, having like all these celebrity, you know, action hero knockoffs fighting aliens on this poster, and only for this poster because it didn't make it to the real, you know, game box art, was just awesome. So I love that one. So.
Yeah, I remember as a kid just having these like lining my room. I had wallpaper basically of like Ninja Gaiden and DuckTales and Mega Man. Just some of the, you know, those classic posters like were some of my like favorite childhood memories, really.
Yeah, I remember using a lot of them back then too. I think I had Iron Sword was one of my favorites from back in the day. Okay, next question comes from Justin Barub, who asks, the first Future published issue had a message from Chris Slate talking about how NP would revive the Insider Community forums. What happened? Not much I can say about this one. Obviously, it was intended to happen, but it couldn't be done. Basically, the manpower and resources to do it properly just weren't available, so unfortunately, it fell by the wayside. That's about all I can say about that. So on to the next question, which comes from Joey T., who asks, what do you guys think the Nintendo Power coverage would look like for games that update and connect you to people around the world, such as Super Mario Maker and Splatoon?
I think there would have been probably a section that was devoted to, you know, some of the updates that came out, you know, since the last issue. So there might have been like a, you know, update corner or like patch notes or something along those lines. Probably wouldn't have been called patch notes, but anyways, just kind of like this reoccurring piece of the magazine that might have shown up just to kind of cover DLC and whatnot.
You know, maybe for stuff like Splatoon, I think that would make sense. I think that a game like Super Mario Maker, we probably would have devoted, you know, a couple of pages to that every issue for like 2 years, I'll bet. You know, highlighting the coolest creations, you know, showing people, you know, how they can get access to these levels. You know, when I think about the stuff we weren't able to do after Nintendo Power shut down, that is one of the things I'm sass about, because there would have been so much amazing stuff to show off in the pages of the magazine.
Yeah, you're right.
But yeah, I think for your average run-of-the-mill updated game, I think a recurring section, maybe something in community or maybe something in the download section, maybe even the news section would have made sense. Yeah, I think like covering tournaments and stuff would have been really cool in community. That would have been fun. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think there would have been lots of possibilities. The next question comes from Jeremy, who asks, what was your favorite memory while working at Nintendo Power? And for me, I've got a few. Certainly, up near the top is the Nintendo Power 20th anniversary party in New York that was held at the Nintendo World store. There was such an outpouring of support from so many people, and seeing these huge crowds line up around the block and, you know, want to get our autographs and stuff was just amazing. I'm sure I've talked about it on the show before, so I won't harp on it too much, but that's certainly, I think, probably my favorite. In addition to that, the Zelda issue where I reviewed the game and was simultaneously working on the strategy guide and trying to review Ace Attorney, and I also fought Rey Mysterio while wearing a mask. You know, was just all kind of one big crazy blur that stands out in my mind. And of course, one of my all-time favorite memories was the time that I hit Pete with a chair. That was a lot of fun,
hey,
too.
Hey, now.
You don't agree?
I don't agree.
So if that wasn't one of your favorite moments, what was your favorite
that
moment?
That was not one of my favorite moments, for the record. One of my favorite, I've mentioned this before, I used to wear the Mario costume quite a bit.
Oh, right, right.
And they'd make me do random things. One of them was punching a cow in a meat locker. A frozen cow, a dead cow. It wasn't,
I mean, you would have enjoyed punching a live cow, though. I know it.
Now that's you. So I remember standing, I can't remember what this was for now, but it was basically I was standing in the Mario costume on a street corner in downtown Redmond with a sandwich board on my neck, and yeah, and I just remember not thinking that was the funnest moment, but in hindsight it was kind of fun. Like, when do you get to do that?
Okay, fair enough. Another question from Jeremy is, considering how nostalgia is strong among Nintendo fans, with the discontinued NES Classic and the soon-to-be-released Super NES Classic as great examples, would an official Nintendo Power revival be successful, in your opinion? And my opinion is yes, definitely. The brand is still strong. It has a lot of great memories for a lot of people. So I think if Nintendo were to bring it back, you know, whether it's a magazine or a website or a weekly email newsletter, as long as it has good content written by people who care, I think people would enjoy it. I think it could make a successful comeback.
Yeah, and I think it's as strong as, you know, the Nintendo brand itself. So as long as Nintendo's doing well, there's always room for the magazine.
Next question comes from Ryan Silverman, who asks, was it required by higher-ups or something to mention an M-rated game's rating every time it was written about? And the answer to that is actually yes,
yep.
Pretty much. It was important. You know, Nintendo obviously has a very diverse audience, and you don't want to go around promoting an M-rated game to young kids without some sort of warning. So it was either putting that at the beginning of the paragraph when you're writing about it, or having to stick a big chunky ESRB logo on every article, which I think the magazine did do at one time.
Yeah.
But I think that just being able to, you know, write it there when appropriate was the much better choice. So I think it is the right thing to do. Next question comes from Plunktoon2, who writes, what would you consider to be the biggest Nintendo Power no-no? In other words, something that would be frowned upon if it were in the magazine. For me, I would say disrespecting your audience. You know, I hear a lot of people in the gaming industry, at websites, publications, and things, you know, they like to say that things are, you know, geeky or nerdy, or use words with sort of a negative connotation. And that's something that we pretty much never did at Nintendo Power. It was always, you know, this stuff is cool. Pokemon is cool. Kirby is cool. Mario is cool. And don't let anyone tell you otherwise. So being respectful to the brands and to your readers, I think, is probably the number one thing. What would you say, Pete?
That's a good one, Chris. You're making me all, you know, getting soft inside. I think the one that stands out in my mind was whenever the words Final Fantasy were written in any sentence, they needed to be all uppercase, and it made articles read a little weird, you know, especially...
Yeah, that was really strange.
Especially a review.
Yeah, fortunately we were able to stop doing that, but yeah, according to, you know, like the Square Enix style guide, that's how it was supposed to be written, so yeah, eventually we got away from that.
Yeah, it made your game reviews look like advertisements, kind of, or press releases.
You know, the rules would change from time to time, but at one point, we weren't really allowed to have any alcohol reference of any sort in the magazine. you know, for any reason. So if you look carefully, you will see in this one interview with a game developer that his favorite food says beverages instead of wine. In this very same article, you will see screenshots and mention of Xbox games. So that was okay, but mentioning wine, that was a total no-no.
Not okay.
Yeah.
I'm also remembering sort of a chibi-robo side note, but I'll let you take that to your grave if you'd like.
Okay. Well, since you brought it up, yes, there was a point in my chibi-robo article, you know, he's a little robot and he has an electrical cord coming out of his butt, which I referred to in one part of an article as his butt plug. That was not allowed either.
Yeah, I can see why they might.
I think I had to replace it with his butt mounted plug or something like that. But that was definitely out. Next question comes from Nama Chabdi, who asks, why did Slate get shot into space during the magazine's final year? Okay, so now we're getting into some real top secret stuff here. Because the truth is that Slate's attention was split between his duties as being Nintendo Power's EIC and being EIC on MacLife magazine. So I said to him, hey, pick a side, get in or get out. And so then we launched him into space.
Mm-hmm. he got out.
That's how that went down. He continues to ask, how were the star power heroes picked? Pete, obviously this was after your time.
Yeah.
So I will answer this. And the answer is I usually picked them. Two main factors were, did the character have a good history to discuss? And did we have good artwork? Those were probably the most important things. But also diversity was crucial. Like, we didn't want to do characters from the same series over and over again. We wanted to have a mix that included main characters and side characters and heroes and villains, male, female, third party, first party. So just having a diverse mix was very important. Kind of like you know what I do when I'm choosing our special guest at the end of every Power Pros episode. And then Nama Chibidi's third question is, did people submit to be in community? And yes, they did, but that's only part of it. Sometimes things were sent to Pulse. We passed those along to the community editor, but most of the time it was just the community editors being very, very diligent, having their fingers on the pulse of what was going on in the gaming industry, being on the lookout for cool, good stories, and just staying on top of things all the time. And that's where a good bulk of the stories came from. So they submitted, yes, but mostly just the editors being awesome people was the most important thing. The next question is from Kyle Covina, who asks, was there anything you ever wanted to do at Nintendo Power but never got the chance?
Light you on fire?
I should have expected that. For me, not really. I guess I would have liked to have interviewed some of the Treehouse localization folks for the Power Profiles section. And I never got to meet Hironobu Sakaguchi of Final Fantasy fame. That's Final Fantasy all in capital letters, by the way. I did get to interview him by email, but I never got to meet him in person. But other than that, no, I was pretty satisfied with everything we got to do there.
I mean, you know, in hindsight, now that Mr. Iwata is no longer with us, obviously having some sort of interview with him would have been great, but that was...
Actually, yeah, you know. Yeah. Man, now I'm depressed now that you brought that up.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, he was never a Power Profiles guy either, and that would have been really cool, so... Next question comes from Juan Cabrera, who asks, what was your least favorite task to do at Nintendo Power? Pete?
Well, I know mine. That was taking screenshots for you.
Since you brought it up earlier, I can't say I'm surprised. For me, it was all the little odds and ends that had to be finished at the end of the magazine. Usually, that was the table of contents. That was the very last thing that ever got done, because you know, we didn't really know what was going in there until everything else was finished.
Right.
And... you know, I tended to get all my stuff done before everyone else did, so somehow the task always fell to me. But there were also lots of odds and ends in the power-up section. And, you know, sometimes, even though they were just a little tiny small thing, taking care of those every month could be really, really time-consuming. So I really like doing that stuff, but just the fact that it could take a really... you know, inordinate amount of time to come up with the blurbs for A Winner Is and Dodongo Dislikes and the quiz and the Warp Zone where we talked about what happened, you know, in the last 5, 10, 20 years.
Hassle the Hoff.
And No, I never saved that till the end. Yeah, that was my thing. See, that's the thing, is that power-up was not my section, so I don't know why those things always ended up falling to me. Just right. That I guess I had lots of ideas and somehow ended up with a little extra time to do it, because, you know, I spent all the rest of the month working, you know, 25 hours a day to get it all done in time. But yeah, just when you found out that, oh, you forgot to do one of those things, we've got to fill it, and we've only got a little bit of time left, that ended up being, you know, a bit of a chore more than it should have been some of the time.
In all honesty, taking screenshots for you was fun because it felt like an achievement. It actually felt like, you know, I had to do something and accomplish something. And at the end, it felt rewarding. I've never told you that, but I did like it. I think my least favorite part was actually ordering the ROMs themselves. As Chris mentioned, they kind of come in these lock boxes. Like, you know, imagine a Wii in like a metal case. And I'd have to carry like a stack of them to and from like the department where you get them from, and fill out a bunch of paperwork. And yeah, it was maybe not the most fun part of my job.
Understandable. Well, if I'd known that, I would have tried harder to make your life miserable with the screenshots then. Next question comes from Jacob Prosser, who asks, what would you want to be in issue today? What's something you really wanted to cover in NP in the last 5 years since it stopped? So I've got a bit of a list. I would have loved to have done some massive regular content on Super Mario Maker, as I mentioned just a little bit ago. I would have really enjoyed covering Shovel Knight.
Oh, yeah.
You know, obviously that's been a huge game in the last few years, and, you know, it's so Nintendo-y, and that would have been so much fun.
I can imagine.
Amiibo,
I can imagine,
of course.
Shovel Knight cover.
Possibly. I could see that possibly happening. But yeah, I mean, since that was a downloadable game, obviously it would have been a huge boon for the download section. Mm-hmm. NES Classic and Super NES Classic or something that I think would have had really cool NP coverage. And then we have Senran Kagura. Pete, do you know what this game is?
Bless you.
Well, it's a beat-em-up. It is, let's say, a beat-em-up with some very provocative character designs. But we definitely would have covered it in the magazine, and I can only imagine, you know, sending this in for approvals and like imagining people's heads exploding at the artwork that would have been provided for this game. We would have found a way to do it that met everybody's standards. And, you know, people might have noticed that when we've covered games with, you know, female characters, like in Metal Gear Solid Snake Eater and Code of Princess, we've had to sort of cover them up in some way. So I'm sure we'll come up with a creative solution in Senran Kagura. But just thinking about that and, you know, knowing the people who would have had to look at these articles and seeing how their heads would have exploded upon seeing these, I just find hilarious. So I kind of regret that that never happened.
Yeah, that's pretty funny. For me, I think just the fact that the Switch now has the ability to, output at 1080p. At the time, I mentioned this before, but, you know, we were trying to get GameCube and Wii screenshots, and they were less than perfect. There was really no way to capture high-res shots of either of those systems.
Oh, I know what you're saying.
Yeah, so to be able to have, like, an HDMI output on anything at that point would have been amazing. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, just...
But that screenshot button, right? Now you can just, you know, hit that screenshot button, and you take that screenshot and Switch, and, man, that would have just been so easy.
Yeah.
It would have been too easy, almost.
I know. I don't want I would have done with all my free time, really.
Okay, our next question comes from Juan Cabrera, who asks, why is NP more cherished than other magazines? And to that I say, it's like what John Cena once said to me and Steve, and that is, Nintendo Power, the first magazine, the first magazine. I think what he meant was that for a lot of people, you know, it was their first magazine. It was sort of their introduction to video game magazines and an introduction to this awesome, amazing world of Nintendo.
Yep.
And so, because it was that introduction, it was the first thing, I think a lot of that is translated into, you know, nostalgia. And, I mean, of course, we continued to make the best magazine we could for, you know, all those years. And I think that shone through as well.
Yeah, I mean, to your point, I think what it was like, as a kid, you didn't really have insight into what was going on in Nintendo.
That's right. There was no internet or anything like that. So this was, like it says, you know, the source straight from the pros.
Right. And then this magazine kind of felt like somebody lifting up the curtain and kind of letting you come in and take a look. And, mm-hmm. you know, there was this counselor's corner, and you got to kind of learn about the people that worked there. there, and all of it was sort of this like entry point into this world, the world of Nintendo, that you just didn't know that much about.
Our next question comes from Brian Booth, who asks, other than the podcast, which is great, but in the end, just 1 hour a week, what do you think are some of the best contenders out there to fill the Nintendo Power void? Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, I don't really have a good answer to this. I haven't really kept up with Pure Nintendo or Nintendo Force 2 terribly much. There is my own blog, Still Playing with Power, which you can find at chrislehoff.tumblr.com. So there's my shameless plug. But I'll be honest, I don't update that very often. Pete, what do you say?
Personally, I still kind of like reading Nintendo fan sites. I read everything now. My favorites are probably Go Nintendo and Nintendo Life. Both of them are excellent at covering Nintendo products. And, you know, you always have to look at everything with a little bit of a grain of salt because they are so Nintendo focused. But I kind of like that people aren't just hating on everything and people kind of, you know, they enjoy what Nintendo's up to. Mm-hmm. And it's fun to read. And I do think that there's a gap missing from where Nintendo Power used to fill the void.
Yeah, that kind of leads us into our next question, which comes from Michael Opferman, who asks, what one thing do you miss the most from your time there? And I would say the number one thing would be that sense of community and camaraderie in the Nintendo world on an everyday basis. I mean, social media helps make up for that. This podcast helps make up for that. We get to interact with, you know, lots of people thanks to the internet. But, you know, it's still, you know, not quite the 24-hour Nintendo community that we sort of got out of Nintendo Power.
Yeah, and for me, I think it was that feeling of like, holy crap, I work at Nintendo Power.
Yes, I guess the other things I miss are the abundant daily street passes and getting to stroke Pete's beard.
Hey, I miss you saying strawberry.
Well, I can do that for you after the show. Next question comes from Michael Jacques, who asks, what do you think NP brought to the table that current Nintendo coverage is missing? What made it unique in your mind? And for me, it was a combination of five factors. It was, first and foremost, dedicated. Everybody knew if you wanted Nintendo information, that was the place to go. Very enthusiastic. Everybody on the staff really, truly loved Nintendo and loved what they were doing. It was substantial. You got a lot of content, and it was regular. It came every single month. It's not like the Nintendo Directs, where sometimes you have to wait, you know, 4 or 5 months for the next one. And then, of course, there was the fact that we had access. You know, we were right there. We were in the Nintendo building, or it was super easy just to call up someone at Nintendo on the phone and find out what's going on and, you know, have that direct connection to the Big N. So that combination of things is something that I feel like no one else has really had, you know, either before or since.
Yeah, I think for me, it's just the nostalgia factor. I don't think there is necessarily a secret recipe. I like all the answers you gave. Hmm. But, you know, I think it is a little bit looking through it with the rose-colored glasses.
Next question comes from Juan Cabrera, who asks, when was NP most popular? That's a factual question. I'm sure you could look that up and find that out. But, you know, it was early on. It was, I mean, I know that Nintendo Power used to have subscribers like in the millions, and that was probably, you know, in the heyday of the NES, I would guess. So I don't really have a good answer for this. But if I had to make a good guess, I would say the numbers probably started dropping off after Pete started working there.
Hey, no. Yeah, I mean, I think the height of the heyday was back in the late 80s, early 90s. There was, you know, more things that are fighting for your attention, you know, as time went on, and there's like, you know, three different consoles on the market. I think that at that time, there just wasn't a lot of things for kids like that. So I think that it definitely had an impact.
Yeah, I don't really understand what you were saying, but I'm going to assume you mean that, you know, that was really the, you know, number one source. You know, now you have a zillion websites and tons of other ways to get your game content. But back then, during the NES heyday, that was really where you would go. So it would not surprise me that that would be when it was most popular.
Yeah, that's what I was trying to say, Jerick.
Next question comes from Jonathan Sopkak, who asks, who was the longest tenured Nintendo Power staff member or contributor? I guess I don't have a 100% certain answer for this one either, but I would guess it would have to either be senior editor George Sinfield or our former managing editor, who was essentially our EIC, Scott Pelland. I mean, both of those guys got involved very early on, and I think they were continue to be involved for like 20 years, even after it came out to Future. they were still doing stuff on a freelance basis and writing reviews and features.
Yeah, unless you count Nestor. I think maybe he has them beat. I don't know.
I don't think so. Nestor was gone for a long time, man. He only came back for very, very periodic appearances after his initial run. So, to be honest, I'm certain that George and Scott have those guys beat.
Yeah, I agree.
Next question, it comes from Javadoz, who asks, was Alan Averill really a slime the whole time? I believe I was hired to fill Alan's position after he left, so I never really worked with him directly. But, Pete, you probably know more about this.
You know, honestly, I don't really know how that all came to be, but I can assure you he really was a slime.
All right, excellent. Next question, it comes from Ferquin NC Root, who asks, what are the other ex-Nintendo Power staffers doing these days? You know, all I can say about that is that, you know, I want them to have some measure of privacy, so it's not really something I want to discuss here. But suffice to say, many of them have found new employment in other jobs in the gaming industry.
Yeah, except for George. I think he now works for the circus.
Ah, well, that would make sense. Next question comes from Mr. Video 95. What was the process of putting together the Nintendo top 285 games list in the final issue?
Well, that's all you, because I wasn't around for that.
Well, the answer is obvious. We had a massive dance-off.
You would.
No, that's not true. It was probably a lot like putting together the NP Top 200 list, where all the current staffers put together their own lists of, you know, in this case, I think it was probably the top 200 games, and then the games were each weighted, you know, the number one game, you know, that was weighted 200 points. Their last game only got 1 point. So they were all weighted, compiled into a list. I think we ended up being short a few games due to so much overlap, so we expanded our list and gave it another go until we came up with 285. After that, we had all the games picked out. We went over the list as a group to make sure everything just felt right, because doing it purely mathematically can sometimes have weird results, so we just fine-tuned it by hand until everybody was more or less happy with it. And that is how it went down. Hmm. Next question comes from Mr. O, who says, what do you think could have been done, if anything, to keep Nintendo Power alive? And I don't think that's really a question I can answer. Perhaps the better question is, how would NP have changed with the times if it had stuck around? And regarding that, you know, I like to think there are a lot of ways that we could have improved things and modernized it. I think it would have been great to have had a digital edition. I think it would have been great to have a better web presence. I think it would have been great to have been on social media.
Yeah.
And of course, to have had our own podcast. You know, maybe somewhere there was an alternate universe out there where Power Pros is the official Nintendo Power podcast, but it's unfortunate that never came to be while the magazine still existed on this timeline.
Yeah, it's interesting. During our time, you know, there was an online team, and then there was also the Nintendo Power magazine, and I feel like there probably should have been more overlap of those two sources at some point. You know, and you see that a lot with like companies like IGN and things where, you know, there's a lot of video content now and things of that nature. So I could just see more of that, if anything.
And now we come down to our last question, which is from Jason Lee, who asks, what was it like working on the last issue? I thought it was phenomenal. The cover, Nestor grown up, etc. I teared up when I finished it. And my answer to this is bittersweet. It was definitely a bittersweet experience. Nintendo and Future really had our backs when we were doing this. They wanted us to go out with a bang. They allowed us to. They didn't just pull the plug. They gave us the time and the budget to do it right. And that's why we were able to bring back a lot of the old personalities. That's why we were able to do the Nestor comic, have the Clay cover homage. So yeah, going away really sucked, but I am very appreciative that they let us give it our all and go out in style.
Fantastic.
And with that, this Q&A comes to a close. Again, thanks to everyone who sent in questions, and a very special thanks to those of you that have been with us since the very beginning. This has gone on for a very long time, so I suppose we had better wrap up this 100th episode of the Power Pros podcast. However, before we go, we still have time for one more thing, and that is a dramatic reading.
Oh, no. No, you didn't.
This time, from the back of the box of the NES game, Rygar. You and Rygar, the legendary warrior of Argul, must defeat the evil king and his army of dangerous beasts. With powers and weapons from the Endora war gods, you go into battle with Rygar. It's up to you. The enemies are strong, the terrain treacherous, and the challenge is difficult. The sun is setting and Rygar is depending on you. Rygar's exploits were once confined to arcades, but now he is battling the forces of evil everywhere. Join forces with Rygar.
Wow.
Yeah.
I like how it broke the fourth wall a few times.
Really? I always found that to be amusing on these old game boxes when they just sort of like, you know, try to beat into your head over and over again. No, it's not Rygar. It's you and Rygar. It's you and Mega Man. It's you and Mario. And it's like, I know I'm the one playing. I know I'm not just watching this thing. We understand how it works. So that always amuses me.
Well, yeah, it's like me and my beard.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. Anyway, with that said, that does it for this week. As always, you can find us at powerpros.podbean.com. You can follow us at PowerProsPod on both Facebook and Twitter. You can follow me, The Hoff, on Twitter at ChrisTheHoff, and you can find Pete at BurlyRedYeti. You can email us at powerprospod@gmail.com. And of course, if you like the podcast, it'd be great if you would leave us a rating on iTunes or tell a friend. Thanks for listening, everybody. For myself, Pete Michaud.
Here's to 100 more.
And the Lord of Darkness, Dracula.
Everything must burn.
We will see you next time.